This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
I'm Tony Brisky. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts as to not miss any breaking updates and discussions on the stories that we're following for you right here. You can even get a commercial-free experience through Apple Podcasts. Today, we're talking about Alec Murdoch with licensed psychologist Dr. John Delatorre. John Delatorre, he provides therapy and assessment for a variety of concerns, including providing interventions to the severely mentally ill, individuals with significant trauma histories, and crisis interventions and de-escalations. John, gosh, if you could be there for some of the people we talk about and have intervened earlier, we probably wouldn't be talking about a lot of these people. Alec Murdoch is who I want to focus on in this conversation today. Obviously, lots and lots going on with the trial. We're viewing his behavior from police standpoints during the interrogation video. We're hearing testimony, we're hearing recordings, and we're seeing his reactions to all of those things in the courtroom. But I want to go all the way back to that 911 call that was made. Very frantic, someone that seems to be in great distress for someone who has allegedly killed their family. Well, innocent until proven guilty, though. What do you make out of that 911 call when you hear it?
You know, if he did not commit the crimes, to see your two loved ones, essentially, I mean, given the testimony that has been given as to the state of the bodies from these shots, I mean, it would be a gruesome scene.
Yeah.
It would be something that your mind can never truly really process to know that you were just on the phone with your wife only to find her the way that she was. And there's your son. Right. Not to be graphic, but, yeah, you know, given what happened to his head. And so these would be images that you could never get out of your head in any real way.
Mm-hmm.
And if he did do this at that, the idea is that he's actually detached, that he wouldn't be experiencing what he was seeing emotionally. The same way there could still be emotions because the gravity of the situation could still be eliciting an emotional response. But if he did do these things, he's long since thought of these individuals, his wife and his son, as merely objects, not human beings. So it wouldn't be impacting him the same way, even though the emotional response could be very similar. They don't start from the same place.
That makes sense. From what you've observed thus far in the Alec Murdoch trial, body language in court to his statements and his language in the interrogation video, what are your observations and thoughts from your position?
He's a curious guy. He's a very curious guy. I mean, when you listen to him, his voice doesn't seem to match his body appearance. Right, he's got a strange tremor that happens when he's a bit anxious. There's something very curious about him. I'm constantly wondering what's actually going on inside his head at any given moment, because I'm not entirely convinced that he sees the world the same way that other people do. I don't, there's just something about him that always strikes me as just a tad bit off, and I really cannot quite place why he seems off.
Is it a result of just entitlement? I mean, look at the family. It's, you know, referred to as a legacy or whatever you want to call it, and just always having whatever he needs, whenever he needs it, and being able to be above the law in many cases. Once that's so ingrained and conditioned in you, is he still operating from that sort of, you know, MO, even though all of those things, for the most part, have come crumbling down?
I mean, it's certainly possible. Not only is it that he's trying to live up to a legacy, he's unsuccessful in doing so. I mean, the allegation from the prosecution is that he did these things to distract from the financial crimes that he had actually been involved in. So it's certainly possible that, given the legacy by which he thought he needed to live up to and was unsuccessful in doing, and that whole world was about to come crashing down, it's certainly possible that that's what led to these sort of more curious kinds of behaviors and mannerisms and ways of thinking about things that we see with him.
An interesting thought that I've been having over the last couple of days on this case, could this be almost like a reverse type suicide? If one is realizing their world is coming to crash down and all of those who he supports around him are soon to see this and fully grasp the gravity of his crime, sometimes people go off into the corner and end it for themselves because they can't take on the burden or the pain or the shame of what they've brought upon their family. That would be one way of ending. And I suppose another may also be to eliminate those people that you are letting down so you don't have to face their wrath, if you will, or their emotions or their disappointment in you for everything that you have destroyed. Could that also be a motive of just not being able to cope with the shame that one has brought their family, and rather than exiting the world because they're such a narcissist, they'd rather eliminate all those around them?
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly a plausible theory. I know, you know, prior to this case happening, there was this allegation that he had hired someone to try to kill him in a car or something like that. You know, so it's certainly possible that this is, despite the level of complexity the prosecution's case is, I don't think he really thinks through that level of thought. I don't really have that level. I don't really think that he has that sort of deviant sort of, you know, I'm a criminal mastermind kind of thing. I do think that this guy seems to be a bit more swayed by the emotions of things. When you see clips of him interacting with others, particularly when it comes to this, you do see this level of just intense distress that he has. Whether it's real or not, it still seems pretty intense of the experience that he's going through, to have that level of sophistication and planning to kind of manipulate all the pieces would require someone who's probably a little bit more detached from their emotions, because emotions can get in your way when you have more sophisticated decision-making. So it's certainly possible that he truly thought that the best route to take would be to kind of kill this family member while himself. But the problem is that he still had another son, and that son apparently didn't really have any violence happen towards him.
Mm-hmm. That is true. That is true. That one son is still there. I guess the argument could be made if he thought he was going to get away with this, which I suppose if one is attempting to carry this out, you're going to assume you're going to get away with it. Who's to say there wouldn't have been a possibility of some way to eliminate him further down the road if he was not caught and continued to be believed that this was a murder that did not take place by him. When a person like Alex is being accused of such a horrible crime and they're in trial, do they ever literally go to a space mentally of believing that they are innocent as a method of coping? Could if we assume that he is guilty, which obviously innocent until proven guilty, but assuming that he is guilty, could he be sitting up there in court fully believing that he did not do this because it's simply a memory that is blacked out in his mind?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and any of us could actually be in that position where we have convinced ourselves that we are actually innocent of an offense that potentially we actually did. Any one of us could have that same mindset that if I just believe it hard enough, then it's going to be real.
That's amazing. It's hard to understand what Alex's surviving son Buster might be going through right now. We've seen him in court almost every day. He, of course, prior to all of this, had a very entitled life to have it all not only crashing down financially around him, but his family is dead. His father's on trial for murder. In your experience working with trauma victims, how does a person like that get through and cope with something of this nature that's all coming at you at once on a national attention level?
It takes time, right? And I think really it's individually based. No one goes through similar kinds of trauma the exact same way. it's certainly possible that he may be of a mindset that, you know, my dad did not do this. Now, maybe there's a thought in there that popped in that maybe he did do this or not, whatever is going through. But it's important to understand that whatever it is that he's going through, it's absolutely normal. It's one thing for us to be talking about Alec Murdaugh and what he would be going through. But for Buster, I think there's going to be a lot of emphasis. There's a spotlight on him. There's emotions that he needs to elicit that he can't because he's on camera. There's so many different things that he might be experiencing that it would be important for him to understand that whatever he's feeling is absolutely normal. And whatever he's thinking is absolutely normal. And when it stops becoming, you know, just this kind of, okay, let me just get through this. When it stops becoming that thing and it starts being hyper-focused on what that stuff is, then that's when he needs outside intervention. That's when he needs professional help to sort of manage what those emotions and what those thoughts are.
From what you've seen in the case so far, the allegations, pretty much it seems to be a lot of let's throw spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks in the defense of Alec Murdaugh. The idea of two killers possibly being involved in this. And I say that with also saying not to disclude Alec as well. I think it could be a real possibility if there are two that he was one of them. Do you feel, I mean, the nature of this, that there could possibly be others involved in these murders? And if so, and Alec's involved, how does one hide that?
I don't know how well he would be able to hide it if he did put together some kind of team to do this. I don't know how well he hides it, because just thinking it from a logical investigative standpoint, two guns means two shooters. But the problem is that one victim was shot from far away, right? That's Maggie. And then one victim was shot up close with a shotgun.
Well, Maggie, actually, I want to correct you there. Maggie was not shot from far away. There was it's stipend, basically, is what it is. It's on her skin, which you only get when a rifle is shot or a firearm is shot very close to you. It's burning from the actual heat of the gun itself. So I believe they were trying to argue that it was from a distance, but the evidence shows that would be impossible by that physical damage on her.
And so then we're left with, well, then why use two different ones? If it's one person, why use two different guns? If it's one person who's willing to do both of the shots, right? Because clearly, if you're comfortable doing one shot up close and you're comfortable doing both shots up close, why switch?
Yeah.
And, can he do this? Can Alec Murdaugh do this? I don't know that he can. The distressing nature of shooting someone with a rifle or shooting someone with a shotgun. I don't know. Considering the level of emotionality that he does exhibit, would he be capable of doing both? I just don't know. And I have not seen the prosecution's case legitimately put the gun or gun in his hand.
And that's the thing. To most of us that are looking at this, it is just the idea of shooting your own child, especially with a shotgun, and seeing what the results of that were. It's disturbing. Of course, in the last handful of days, words have come out that are being argued. Did he say I, or did he say they did them so bad? When I listen to that, I hear the word I. It's all a matter of perception, I guess. But could this be something where he came out and was crying and saying those things, where it was a Freudian slip of some sort? That, or, you know, with that statement, does it hold much weight? Is it just another Southern euphemism or something of that nature?
Well, I don't know if it's a Southern euphemism, but I think the real problem is that because the officer did not follow up, its impact, I think, on the jury is now worthless, because there are so many different theories as to why he would have said whatever it was, whether it's I or they. Mm-hmm. There's so many different reasons why someone would say either one of those things. Because the officer chose not to follow up and get more information, the jury is most likely just going to disregard it because there's nothing else behind the state.
Yeah. It's hard to judge intent. And I did him so bad, honestly, could mean many things. Doesn't mean necessarily mean murdered. Could have mean I didn't protect him. I did him so bad. That this somehow happened. And I'm not trying to make arguments for him, but it's one of those things where it really logically could go any way, especially when someone is trying to cope with that sort of trauma at that moment in time, guilty or not.
Yeah, no. I agree. And again, this is not to try to make excuses for whatever it was that's going on. The jury is ultimately the one that's going to decide what the truth is. But if you're the prosecution and you're trying to say that this guy has engaged in a criminal mastermind, right, so sophisticated of a plan to distract from other issues, if you think that this is the guy that did it, then you have to have all your I's dotted and T's crossed. And by the cop not following up on that statement and you not even including that statement in your opening statement, right? It's not something that you kind of harped on as the prosecutor.
Yeah.
Then you leave it wide open to almost to the point that it's not relevant anymore in the jury's mind.
Dr. John Delatorre, licensed psychologist, thank you so much for your thoughts and insights into this very fascinating case. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any of our discussions and conversations on this and many other cases. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Until next time, for all of us here, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.